7. As they ascended, the chaotic darkness began to fade. The layer of clouds dribbled moistly past them. With a wet slither, the umbrella burst through. Instead of the chill black of night, they were rising in a dull medium of discriminate gray, an unformed expanse of colorless, shapeless nothing. Below lay the Earth. It was the best view Hamilton had ever had of the Earth. In many ways it met his expectations. It was round and quite clearly a globe. Suspended in its medium, the globe hung quietly, a somber but impressive object. Especially impressive because it was unique. Shocked, Hamilton realized that no other planets were heaving into view. He peered up apprehensively, gazed around him, gradually and reluctantly absorbing what his eyes made out. The Earth was alone in the firmament. Around it wheeled a blazing orb, much smaller, a gnat buzzing and flickering around a giant, inert bulb of matter. That, he realized with a thrill of dismay, was the sun. It was tiny, and it moved. Si muove, but not Terra. Si muove, the sun. Fortunately, the glowing, burning bit of phosphorescence was on the far side of the mighty Terra. It moved slowly. Its total revolution was a 24-hour period. On this side came a smaller, almost unnoticed speck, a corroded wad of waste material that dully plodded along, trivial and dispensable. The moon. It wasn't far off. The umbrella was going to carry him almost within touching distance. Incredulous, he gazed at it until it fell away into the gray medium. Was science, then, in error? Was the whole scheme of the universe mistaken? The vast and overwhelming structure of the Copernican heliocentric system all wrong? He was seeing the ancient, outmoded, geocentric universe, with a giant, unmoving Earth, the only planet. Now he could make out Mars and Venus, bits of material so tiny as to be virtually non-existent. And the stars, they too were incredibly tiny, a canopy of insignificance. In an instant, the entire fabric of his cosmology had come tottering down into ludicrous ruin. But it was only here. This was the ancient Ptolemaic universe, not his world. Tiny sun, tiny stars, the great obese blob of an Earth, swollen and bloated, occupying dead center. That was true here. That was the way this universe was run. But that meant nothing concerning his own universe, thank God. Having accepted this, he was not particularly surprised to observe a deep underlayer far below the grayness, a reddish film beneath the Earth. It looked as if down at the very bottom of this universe, a primitive mining operation was going on. Forges, blast furnaces, and, further into the distance, a kind of crude volcanic simmering sent vague flashes of sinister red to color the nondescript medium of gray. It was hell. And above him, he craned his neck. Now it was clearly visible. Heaven. This was the other end of the phone system. This was the station to which the electronics men, the semanticists, the experts on communication, the psychologists, had linked Earth. This was point A on the great cosmic wire. Above the umbrella, the drifting grayness faded out. For an interval, there was nothing, not even the chill night wind that had frozen his bones. McFaith, clutching the umbrella, watched in growing awe as the abode of God grew closer. Not much of it was visible. An infinite wall of dense substance stretched out, a protective layer that blocked off any real view. Above the wall drifted a few luminous specks. The specks darted and leaped like charged ions, as if they were alive. Probably they were angels. It was too soon to see. The umbrella rose, and so did Hamilton's curiosity. Amazingly, he was quite calm. Under the circumstances, it was impossible to feel emotion. Either he was totally self-controlled, or he was overwhelmed. It was one or the other. There was no in-between. Soon, in another 5 minutes, he would be carried above the wall. He and McFaith would be looking into heaven. A long way, he thought. A long way from the moment when they had stood in the hall of the Bevatron building, facing each other, arguing over some petty trifle. Gradually, almost imperceptibly, the ascent of the umbrella diminished. Now it was barely rising. This was the limit. Above this, there was no up. Idly, Hamilton wondered what would happen. Would the umbrella begin to descend as patiently as it had climbed, or would it collapse and deposit them in the middle of heaven? Something was coming into view. They were parallel with the expanse of protective material. An inane thought crept into his mind. The material was there, not to keep passers-by from seeing in, but to keep inhabitants from tumbling out, to keep them from tumbling back down to the world from which, over the centuries, they had come.
"We're..." McFay wheezed. "We're almost there."
"Yeah," Hamilton said.
"This has quite an effect on a man's outlook."
"It really does," he admitted. Almost, he could see. Another second, half-second, a vague glimpse of landscape was already coming into view. A confusing vision, some kind of circular continuum, a sort of vaguely misty place. Was it a pond? An ocean? A vast lake, swirling waters, mountains at the far end, an endless range of forest shrubbery. Abruptly, the cosmic lake disappeared. A curtain had swept down over it. But then the curtain, after an interval, swept back up. There was the lake again, the unlimited expanse of moist substance. It was the biggest lake he had ever seen. It was big enough to contain the whole world. As long as he lived, he didn't expect to see a bigger lake. He wondered idly what the cubic capacity of it was. In the center was a denser, more opaque substance, a kind of lake within a lake. Was all heaven just this titanic lake? As far as he could see, there was nothing but lake. It wasn't a lake. It was an eye. And the eye was looking at him and McFaith. He didn't have to be told whose eye it was. McFaith screeched. His face turned black. His wind rattled in his throat. A breath of utter fright swept over him. For an instant, he danced helplessly at the end of the umbrella, trying to force his own fingers apart, trying futilely to pry himself loose from the field of vision, trying, frantically and unsuccessfully, to scramble away from the eye. The eye focused on the umbrella. With an acrid pop, the umbrella burst into flame. Instantly, the burning fragments, the handle, and the two shrieking men dropped like stones. They did not descend as they had come up. They descended at meteoric velocity. Neither of them was conscious. Once, Hamilton was dimly aware that the world was not far below. Then came a stunning impact. He was tossed high in the air again, almost all the way back up. Almost, on this vast first bounce, back to heaven. But not quite. Again he was descending. Again he struck. After a time of indescribable bouncing, his physical self lay inert and gasping, clutching at the surface of the earth, holding on desperately to a bunch of withered grass growing in a soil of dry red clay. Cautiously, painfully, he opened his eyes and looked around. He was spread out on a long plain of dusty, parched country. It was very early morning of another day, and it was quite cold. Meager buildings rose in the distance. Not far off lay the unmoving body of Charlie McFaith. Cheyenne, Wyoming. "I guess," Hamilton managed, after a long interval, "this is where I should have come first." There was no answer from McFaith. He was totally unconscious. The only sound was the shrill twittering of birds perched in a scraggly tree a few hundred yards off. Painfully pulling himself to his feet, Hamilton tottered over and examined his companion. McFaith was alive, and with no apparent injuries, but his breathing was shallow and harsh. A thin ooze of saliva had made a path down his chin from his half-open mouth. His face still wore an expression of terror and wonder, and overpowering dismay. Why dismay? Wasn't McFaith glad of the sight of his god? More peculiar facts to file away, more oddball data in this oddball world. Here he was at the spiritual center of the Babbyist universe, Cheyenne, Wyoming. God had corrected the errant bent in his direction. McFaith had put him on the wrong track, but he was surely and absolutely back. Tillingford had spoken the truth. It was to the prophet Horace Clamp that Providence intended him to come. With curiosity, he surveyed the chill gray outline of the nearby town. In the center, among the otherwise nondescript structures, was one single colossal spire. The spire glowed furiously in the early morning sunlight. A skyscraper? A monument? Not at all. This was the temple of the one true faith. From this distance, several miles away, he was seeing the sepulchre of the second Bab. The Babbyist power, as experienced up to now, would seem a mere trifle compared with what lay ahead. "Get up," he said to McSafe, noticing him stir.
Not me,
McSafe answered.
You go on. I'm staying here.
He rested his head on his arm and closed his eyes.
I'll wait.
While he waited, Hamilton considered his situation. Here he was, set down in the middle of Wyoming, in the chill morning of an autumn day, with only 30 cents in his pockets. But what had Tillingford said? He shuddered. It was worth a try, though, and he didn't have much choice.
Lord,
he began, getting down in the customary posture, one knee to the ground, hands pressed together, eyes turned piously toward heaven.
Reward thy humble servant according to the usual pay scale for Class 4A electronic workers.
Tillingford mentioned $400. For a time, nothing happened. A cold, barren wind whipped over the plain of red clay, rustling the dry weeds and rusty beer cans. Then, presently, the air above him stirred.
Cover your head,
Hamilton yelled at McFaith. A shower of coins rained down, a glittering swirl of dimes, nickels, quarters, and half dollars. With a sound like coal pouring through a tin chute, the coins rattled down, deafening and blinding him. When the torrent had tapered off, he began collecting. Sullen disappointment was his next reaction, once the excitement had worn off. There was no $400 here. He was getting pocket change tossed to a beggar. It was what he deserved, though. The amount, when he tallied it, came to $40.75. It would help. At least he'd be able to keep himself eating. And when that was gone...
Don't forget,
McSafe muttered sickly as he struggled to his feet.
You owe me $10.
McSafe was not a well man. His large face was mottled and unwholesome. His thick flesh hung in ugly, dough-like folds around his collar. Nervously, his fingers plucked at a twitch in his cheek. The transformation was amazing. McSafe had been shattered by the sight of his god. The face-to-face encounter had completely demoralized him.
Wasn't he what you expected?
Hamilton asked, as the two of them plodded dully toward the highway. Grunting, McSafe spat red clay dust into a clump of weeds, and, thrust deep in his pockets, he dragged himself along, eyes blank, slouched over like a broken man.
Of course, Hamilton conceded, it's none of my business. I can use a drink,
was all McSafe had to contribute. As they stepped up onto the shoulder of the highway, he consulted his wallet.
I'll see you in Belmont. Hand over the $10. I'll need it for plane fare.
Hamilton reluctantly counted out $10 in small change, which McSafe accepted without comment. They were entering the suburbs of Cheyenne when Hamilton noticed something foreboding and ominous. On the back of McSafe's neck, a series of ugly swollen red sores were forming, fiery welts that grew and expanded even as he watched.
Boils,
Hamilton observed, astonished. McSafe glanced at him in mute suffering. Presently, he touched his left jaw.
And an abscessed wisdom tooth,
he added, in a totally defeated tone.
Boils and an abscess. My punishment.
For what? Again there was no answer. McSafe was sunk into private gloom, battling with invisible comprehensions. He would be lucky, Hamilton realized, if he survived his encounter with his god. Of course, there was an elaborate mechanism of sin expiation available. McSafe could shed his abscessed tooth and plague of boils with the proper absolutions, and McSafe, the innate opportunist, would find the way. At the first bus stop, they halted and threw themselves wearily down on the damp bench. Passers-by, on their journey into town for Saturday shopping, glanced at them curiously.
Pilgrims,
Hamilton said icily, in answer to an interested stare.
Crawled on our knees from Battle Creek, Michigan.
This time there was no punishment from above. Sighing, Hamilton almost wished there had been. The capricious personality element infuriated him. There was just too little relationship between deed and punishment. The lightning was probably cutting down some totally innocent Cheyennite on the far side of town.
Here's the bus,
McSafe said gratefully, struggling to his feet.
Get out your dimes.
When the bus reached the airfield, McSafe tottered off and wretchedly made his way toward the office building. Hamilton rode on, toward the towering, radiant, imposing structure that was the only true sepulcher. The prophet Horace Clamp met him in the glorious entranceway. Awesome marble columns rose on all sides. The sepulcher was an overt copy of the traditional tombs of antiquity, A kind of seedy, middle-class vulgarity hung about it, vast and impressive as it was, massive, threatening. The mosque was an aesthetic atrocity. Like a government building in the Soviet Union, it had been designed by men lacking artistic sensibility. Unlike the Soviet office buildings, it was larded and smeared with fretwork, embossed with rococo railings and flutings, infinite bric-a-brac, lavishly polished brass knobs and pipings. Recessed indirect lights played over the terracotta surfaces. Stupendous bas-reliefs stood out in pompous stateliness, greater-than-life representations of Middle Eastern pastoral themes. The characters portrayed were moral and fatuous, and elaborately clothed.
"Greetings," the prophet announced, holding up one plump, pale hand in benediction.
Horace Clamp might have stepped from some vividly colored Sunday school poster. Fat, waddling, with an absent, benign expression, robed and hooded, he gathered Hamilton up and prodded him into the mosque proper. Clamp was the living manifestation of the Islamic spiritual leader. As the two of them entered a richly furnished study, Hamilton wondered dismally why he was here. Was this what God had in mind?
"I was expecting you," Clamp said in a businesslike manner. "I was informed of your coming."
"Informed?" Hamilton was puzzled. "By whom?"
"Why, by Tetragrammaton, of course."
Hamilton was baffled.
"You mean you're the prophet of a god named—" "The name cannot be spoken,"
Clamp interrupted with sly agility.
"Much too sacred. He prefers to be referred to by the term Tetragrammaton. I'm rather surprised that you don't know this. It's common public knowledge."
"I'm somewhat ignorant," Hamilton said.
"You have, I understand, recently experienced a vision."
"If you mean did I just see Tetragrammaton, the answer is yes." Already he had developed an aversion to the pudgy prophet.
"How is he?"
"He seemed in good health," Hamilton couldn't refrain from adding, "for someone his age." Clamp roamed busily around the study. Almost bald, his head shone like a polished stone. He was the epitome of theological dignity and pomp, and he was, Hamilton reflected, virtually a caricature. All the timeless, stuffy elements were there. Clamp was just too majestic to be true. Caricature, or somebody's idea of what the spiritual head of the one true faith ought to be like.
"Prophet," Hamilton said bluntly, "I might as well lay it on the line. I've been in this world approximately 40 hours, no longer. Frankly, all this baffles me. As far as I'm concerned, this is an absolutely crackpot universe. A moon the size of a pea, it's absurd. Geocentric, the sun revolving around the earth. It's primitive. And this whole archaic non-Western concept of God, this old man showering down coins and snakes, loosing plagues of boils."
Clamp eyed him acutely.
"But my dear sir, this is the way things are. This is his creation."
"This creation, maybe, but not mine. Where I come from..."
"Perhaps,"
Clamp interrupted,
"you had better tell me where you come from.
Tetragrammaton didn't acquaint me with this aspect of the situation.
He merely informed me that a lost soul was on its way here."
Without much enthusiasm, Hamilton outlined what had happened.
"Ah,"
Clamp said when he had finished. Distressed and skeptical, he flounced about the study, arms behind his back.
"No," he declared, "I really can't accept this. But it could be so, it really could. You assert, you actually stand there and claim that up until Thursday you lived in a world untouched by his presence?"
"I didn't say that. Untouched by a crude, bombastic presence. None of this tribal deity stuff. This bluster and thunder. But he could very well be there. I always took it for granted that he was, in a subtle way, behind the scenes, not kicking them over with his hoof every time somebody steps out of line." The prophet was clearly moved by Hamilton's revelation.
"This is a sensational affair. I hadn't realized there were whole worlds still infidel."
At that, Hamilton lost his temper.
"Can't you grasp what I'm saying? This second-rate universe, this bab or whatever—"
"The second bab,"
Clamp interrupted.
"What is a bab? And where's the first bab? Where did all this nonsense come from?"
After a haughty moment, Clamp said,
"On July 9, 1850, the first Bab was executed at Tabriz. 20,000 of his followers, the Babiyis, were horribly murdered. The first Bab was a true prophet of the Lord. He died transcendentally, causing even his jailers to weep. In 1909, his remains were carried to Mount Carmel. Plant paused dramatically, his eyes full of emotion.
In 1915, 65 years after his death, the Bab reappeared on Earth. In Chicago, at 8 o'clock, on the morning of August 4th, he was witnessed by a group of persons eating in a restaurant. This, despite the proven fact that the remains at Mount Carmel are still intact.
I see, Hamilton said. Raising his hands, Clamp said,
What further proof could be asked? What greater miracle has the world seen? The first Bab was a mere prophet of the one true God.
His voice trembling, Clamp finished.
And the second Bab is he.
Why Cheyenne, Wyoming? Hamilton inquired.
The second Bab ended his days on Earth at this exact spot. On May 21, 1939, he ascended to paradise, carried by five angels in plain sight of the faithful. It was a thrilling moment. I, myself...
Clamp was unable to speak.
I personally received from the second Bab during his last hour on Earth his...
He pointed to a niche in the wall of the study.
In that mihrab is the second Bab's watch, his fountain pen, his wallet, and one false tooth. The rest were genuine and went with him bodily to paradise. I, during the lifetime of the second Bab, was his recorder. I wrote down many sections of the Bayan with this typewriter you see here.
He touched a glass case in which was an old Underwood Model 5 office machine, battered and obsolete.
And now, the Prophet Clamp continued, let us consider this world you describe. Obviously, you've been sent here to acquaint me with this extraordinary situation. An entire world, billions of people, living their lives cut off from the sight of the one true God.
In his eyes, a fervent glow appeared. The glow burgeoned as the prophet's mouth formed the word,
Jihad.
Look, Hamilton began apprehensively, but Clamp cut him brusquely off.
A jihad,
Clamp said excitedly.
We'll get hold of Colonel T.E. Edwards at California Maintenance. Immediate conversion to long-range rockets. First, we'll bombard this blighted region with informational literature of a scriptural nature. Then, when we've sparked some kind of spiritual light in the wilderness, we'll follow through with instructional teams. And after that, a general concentration of peripatetic messengers presenting the true faith through various mass media, television, movies, books, recorded testimonials. I would think Tetragrammaton could be persuaded to do a 15-minute kinescope, and some long-playing messages for the benefit of the unbelievers.
And was this, Hamilton wondered, why he had been summarily dropped at Cheyenne, Wyoming? Surrounded by the certitude of the Prophet Clamp, he was beginning to falter. Maybe he was a sign sent to fulfill the realization of submission. Maybe this was the real world after all, clutched to Tetragrammaton's bosom. Can I look around the sepulchre? He hedged. I'd like to see what the spiritual hub of Second Babaism is like. Preoccupied, Clamp glanced up.
What? Certainly.
Already he was punching buttons on his intercom.
I'm getting in touch with Tetragrammaton immediately.
He halted long enough to lean toward Hamilton, raise his hand, and ask,
Why do you suppose he didn't inform us of this darkened world?
On his face, on the lush, complacent face of the prophet of the second Bab, a floating measure of uncertainty appeared.
I would have thought...
Shaking his head, he murmured,
But the path of God is sometimes strange.
Damn strange, Hamilton said. Leaving the study, he made his way out into the echoing marble corridor.
Even at this early hour, devout worshippers roamed here and there, fingering holy exhibits and gawking. The sight of them depressed Hamilton.
In one large chamber, a group of well-dressed men and women, most of them middle-aged, were singing hymns. Hamilton started to pass by and then thought better of it. Over the group of the faithful hung a faintly luminous and faintly jealous presence. Perhaps, he decided, it would be a good idea to follow along. Halting, he joined the group and reluctantly sang along with them. The hymns were unfamiliar to him, but he quickly picked up the general beat. The hymns had a redundant simplicity. The same phrases and tones appeared and reappeared. The same monotonous ideas repeated indefinitely. The appetite of Tetragrammaton was insatiable, he concluded. A childish, nebulous personality that required constant praise, and in the most obvious terms. Quick to anger, Tetragrammaton was equally quick to sink into euphoria, was eager and ready to lap up these blatant flatteries. A balance, a method of lulling the deity. But what a delicate mechanism, danger for everyone,
the easily aroused presence that was always nearby, always listening. Having discharged his religious duty, he wandered grimly on. Both the building and the people were infested with the stern nearness of Tetragrammaton. He could feel him everywhere, like a thick, oppressive fog. The Islamic god lay over everything. Uneasily, Hamilton examined an immense, illuminated wall plaque. "Roll call of the faithful. Is your name here?" The list was alphabetical. He scanned it and discovered that his name was lacking. So he observed caustically was McFaith, or McFaith. But he would manage. Marcia's name, too, was absent. The list in toto was astonishingly short. Of all mankind, was this meager portion the only group fit to be taken into paradise? Dull resentment boiled inside him. At random, he sought some of the great names he had lived by. Einstein, Albert Schweitzer, Gandhi, Lincoln, John Donne. None was there. His rage increased. What did it signify? Were they condemned to hell because they hadn't been followers of the Second Bab of Cheyenne, Wyoming? Naturally. Only the believers were saved. Everybody else, countless billions, were destined to sink into the corroding fires of hell. The rows of smug names were the rustic provincials who made up the one true faith, trivial personalities, tiny blots of mediocre non-entities. One name was familiar. For a long time he stood staring at it, wondering in a troubled fashion what it meant, wondering, with growing concern, why it was there and what its presence meant. Sylvester, Arthur. The old war veteran. The severe old soldier lying in the hospital at Belmont. He was a charter member of the one true faith. It made sense. It made so much sense that, for a time, he could only stand gazing sightlessly up at the graven name. Feebly, in a dim manner, he was beginning to see how the parts and pieces fitted together. The dynamics were swimming up into plain view. He had finally, at long last, found the structure. The next step was getting back to Belmont and finding Arthur Sylvester. At the Cheyenne airfield, Hamilton pushed all his money across the counter and said, "One-way ticket to San Francisco, the baggage compartment if necessary." It lacked, but a quick telegram to Marcia brought the balance and closed out his savings account. With the money came a cryptic plaintive message. "Maybe you shouldn't come back. Something awful is happening to me." He wasn't particularly surprised. In fact, he had a good idea what it was. The plane deposited him at the San Francisco airport just before noon. From there, he took a Greyhound bus to Belmont. The front door of the house was locked. Sitting despondently in the picture window was the yellow shape of Ninny Numcat, watching him as he searched his pockets for his door key. Marcia was not in sight, but he knew she was there. "I'm home," he announced, when he had got the door open. From the darkened bedroom came a faint, sniffling sob. "Darling, I'm going to die." In the gloom, Marcia thrashed helplessly around. "I can't come out. Don't look at me. Please don't look at me." Hamilton removed his coat and then picked up the telephone. "Get over here," he said when Bill Laws finally answered. "And round up all of the group you can. Joan Rice, that woman and her son, McFaith if you can find him."
"Edith Pritchett and her son are still at the hospital," Laws told him. "God knows where some of the others are. Does it have to be now?"
he explained.
"I have a sort of hangover."
"This evening, then."
"Make it tomorrow," Laws said. "Sunday's soon enough. What's up?"
"I think I've got this business figured out."
"Just when I was beginning to enjoy it."
Ironically, Laws continued,
"And tomorrow's the big day in this here place. Lordy, lordy. We uns, I'm sure, gwine to have ourselves a ball."
"What's wrong with you?"
"Nothing, sir."
Laws chuckled humorlessly.
"Nothing at all."
"I'll see you Sunday, then." Hamilton hung up and turned toward the bedroom. "Come on out," he called sharply to his wife.
"I won't,"
Marcia said with stubborn determination.
"You can't look at me. I've made up my mind."
Standing in the entrance of the bedroom, Hamilton fumbled for his cigarettes. They were gone. He had left them with Silky. He wondered if she were still sitting in his Ford coupe, parked across the street from Father O'Farrell's non-Babaist church. Perhaps she had seen him and McFaith rise to paradise. But she was a sophisticated girl. She wouldn't be surprised. So no harm was done.
except that it might be a while before he got his car back. "Come on, baby," he said to his wife. "I'm hungry for some breakfast, and if it's what I think it is..."
"It's awful."
Loathing and pain shuddered through Marcia's voice.
"I was going to kill myself. Why? What have I done? What's it punishment for?"
"It's not punishment," he told her gently, "and it'll go away."
"Really?"
Slim Hope touched her.
"Are you positive?"
"If we handle this situation right, I'll go sit in the living room with Ninny. We'll be waiting."
"He's seen already,"
Marcia said in a strange, choked voice.
"He's disgusted."
"Cats disgust easily." Returning to the living room, Hamilton threw himself down on the couch and waited patiently. For a time, nothing stirred. Then, from the dark bedroom, came the first sounds of ponderous movement. A shape, awkward and clumsy, was making its way forward. A pang of compassion rose in Hamilton's breast. The poor darn creature. And not to understand it. At the doorway, a figure emerged. Gross, squat, it stood facing him. Forewarned as he was, the shock overwhelmed him. The resemblance to Marcia was only slight. Was this tubby, bloated monstrosity his wife? Tears leaked down her coarse cheeks.
"What?"
she whispered.
"What'll I do?"
Getting up, he came rapidly toward her. "It won't last long, and you're not the only one. Laws shuffles and talks in dialect."
"I don't care about laws, I care about me."
The change had touched every part of her. What had once been soft brown hair was now dirty, stringy fibers hanging over her neck and shoulders, an unclean tangle of twisted strands. Her skin was gray and pebbled, broken out with acne. Her body was a lumpy pudding, shapeless, grotesque. Her hands were immense, her nails chipped and blackened. Her legs were two white furry columns that ended in massive flat feet. Instead of her usual chic dress, she wore a coarse wool sweater, stained tweed skirt, tennis shoes, and wrinkled bobby socks. Hamilton walked critically around her.
"It makes sense."
"Is this God's?"
"This has nothing to do with God. This has to do with an old war veteran named Arthur Sylvester, a crackpot old soldier who believes in his religious cult and his stereotyped ideas. To him, people like you are dangerous radicals. And he has a very clear idea what a radical, a young radical woman, looks like."
Marcia's coarse features twisted painfully. "I look like a cartoon."
"You're what Sylvester imagines a young radical college woman would look like. And he thinks all Negroes shuffle. This is going to be tough on all of us. Unless we get out of Sylvester's world pretty damn soon, it's going to be our finish."